following is based on true events.
Good evening and hello. Tonight's episode is going to have a fairly spooky vibe. It would be perfect as a Halloween episode, but it's February and we don't want to keep you guys waiting. Normally at this juncture in the episode, I emphasise that the importance of science and fact and guarantee that what you're about to hear is 100% factual and based on corroborated evidence and supported by a multitude of science and so on. Now, while tonight's episode is 100% true and taken from documented accounts, it's also an event that I was an eyewitness to myself. But I cannot, however, support the events discussed on tonight's episode with any science or theories, etc., to back up its legitimacy. In fact, some of the events that you're about to hear would seemingly defy science. But I'm guessing that you guys know that. You're tuning in regardless, I hope, to see what we've got on the table this evening. Now, before you guys turn this episode off, before we've even begun, we aren't talking eccentric levels of crazy here, just the other side of things that we experience in life, namely religion. You see, without science or corroborated facts, billions of people the world over take steps and make decisions based on faith and faith alone. Well, tonight we're in that realm, my friends. Tonight, all I am simply asking that you do is listen with an open mind and form your own opinions at the end of the episode. For those willing to go one step further, I'm asking you to take my hand in trust and simply believe. So tonight, everyone, this is The Ritual. Generally, like in the run-up to Halloween, for example, many of us are open to a frightening supernatural adventure, a good scare that can be a bonding experience. And in this spirit, many of us have dabbled with Ouija boards, either in earnest or jest. Perhaps even getting slightly fazed by the apparent disembodied messages, sometimes surreal and foreboding, emanating from the board. While there is no evidence that we can truly communicate with the dead, phenomena like Ouija board and automatic writing can truly give us a fascinating insight into our own psychology and serve as a reminder that we can all too easily fool ourselves. Our fascination with words from beyond the grave is nothing new. In the mid-19th century, the growing spiritualist movement had begun to experiment with ghostly message transcribed by table turning, a precursor to the modern Ouija board. In table turning, the alphabet was inscribed on a table upon which all participants laid their hands. Seemingly ethereal whisperings would soon appear from the void as the table tilted towards the imprinted letters. Such demonstrations of spiritualism convinced many in high society that a new force, perhaps a mystical one, was behind the haunting messages. But not everyone was so easily convinced. Michael Faraday, the prominent British scientist, was incredibly dubious on the claims of the spiritualists. To test the phenomenon, he had set about eliminating variables and alternative explanations. Using wood and rubber to increase resistance to movement, he observed no effect on the table's motion. His efforts showed that no special force was at play, and that his continued investigations led him to conclude that far from being some bizarre supernatural event, table tipping was nothing more than a quasi-involuntary muscular action. Faraday's careful experiments had revealed that there was no mysterious force at play, natural or supernatural, just the propensity for men and women to delude themselves. This conclusion was supported by the meticulous parallel experiments of French chemist Michel Eugène Chevriel. Chevriel was steadfastly opposed to charlatanism. In his 1854 paper on the subject, he turned his attention to table turning, divining rods, and magic pendulums, demonstrating how involuntary and subconscious muscle reactions are the cause of ostensibly magic movements. More than this, Chevriel discovered that once the person holding the rod was made aware of the reaction, the movement ceased and could not be reproduced. That same year, the term idiomotor was introduced by physician William Carpenter to describe this very phenomenon. The discovery of the idiomotor effect demonstrated that there was no mystery underpinning the eerie happenings of the late 19th and early 20th century seances. merely the heady mixture of delusion and occasionally outright fraud. Many of the popular trance mediums of the area used unadulterated showmanship to improve their audience members. Famed medium Mina Crandon performed her seances nude, for example, and allegedly secreted ectoplasm from her vagina, before being debunked by renowned magician and escape artist Harry Houdini. Houdini had something of a passion for debunking frauds, and took a delight in exposing trickery using his expertise in the subject to detect bogus claims. This made him highly unpopular with spiritualists of the era, some of whom, such as Sherlock Holmes creator Arthur Conan Doyle, believed that Houdini himself had spiritualist powers, a claim that irked the proud professional no end. Another individual not taken in by passion for spiritualism was Charles Arthur Mercier, a psychiatrist with precious little time for nonsense. Mercier had spent a great deal of time debunking trance mediums, painstakingly dismantling their claims, and his particular bugbear was automatic writing, the supposedly supernatural channeling of writing from a remote source. Mercier's investigations showed that the only curious phenomena at play was yet another variant of the ideomotor effect. Summing up his findings for the British Medical Journal in 1894, he robustly dismantled the spiritualist presumption that spirits were the cause of automatic writing by slating bluntly, "There is no need nor room for the agency of spirits, and the invocation of such agency is the sign of a mind not merely unscientific, but uninformed." This should have spelled the end for everything from dowsing to Ouija boards. Yet to this day, they remain devoutly held beliefs for many. And despite the existence of ideomotor effect being known for almost two centuries, the infinite human capacity for reinvention and our seeming inability to learn from our mistakes means that we can still fall prey to the same illusions under different packaging. In 2013, businessman Jim McCormick was convinced of selling useless bomb dowsing kits to the Iraqi army, a modern twist on the divining rod. Another inglorious 2013 entry in the ideomotor catalogue was the CFAST, a mechanical dowsing rod its inventors claim would detect liver disease. A claim which C.L. Lane of Sense About Science dissected as pushing hope and nothing more. Yet perhaps the most prominent and damaging modern offshoot of the ideomotor effect is the phenomenon of facilitated communication. In this process, a facilitator helps move the arm of a patient to a screen or keyboard so that they may apparently communicate, an interaction heralded by believers as a breakthrough, allowing those with severe communication issues to express themselves. In the late 1980s, facilitated communication, or FC, was at the zenith of its popularity. For patients and family of the non-verbal autistic and the severely intellectually disabled, it offered incredible promise. Wonderful stories of FC unlocking the minds of patients were shared far and wide, and anecdote became traded as evidence. Profoundly mentally handicapped children overnight became poets and savants, even publishing books with their facilitators. But while FC was wholeheartedly embraced by many, the warning signs of pseudoscience were clear from the offset. As early as 1991, over 40 empirical studies showed no evidence of efficacy, but plenty of facilitator input. The decline of FC also pivoted on a number of unpleasant sexual abuse claims, and the media attention that they spawned. The late 80s and early 90s had seen a string of bogus recovered memory cases, alleging satanic ritual abuse, and subsequent of mass panic over claims which were shown to be baseless, created by those recovering the memories. Given this trend, it was perhaps inevitable that the messages communicated through FC would rapidly become darker, and by the mid-1990s, FC practitioners had revealed hidden sexual abuse in scores of their clients, and a number of arrests based on this testimony took place. The case of 16-year-old non-verbal autistic Betsy Wheaton ignited interest when she ostensibly communicated that though her facilitator and her father makes me hold his penis, soon she was detailing the most horrific abuse allegedly perpetrated by a wide cross-section of her family. Speech pathologist Howard Shane was able to put together a simple yet ingenious test to determine the source of the messages, and the trials were conducted by psychologist Douglas Howler. The apparatus displayed pictures of both Betsy and her facilitator, Jane Boynton, and Betsy was asked to identify the subject she saw. Yet in the same trials, she and Jane were deliberately shown different pictures. In every instance, Betsy communicated only what Jane saw, clear evidence that the communication came from the communicator and not from the individual. The same result was shown when similar experiments were repeated with others, all returning the same null result. The evidence was clear. FC was nothing more than self-delusion, buttressed by the ubiquitous idiomotor effect. The facilitators weren't unlocking the thoughts of profoundly disabled patients. They were subconsciously projecting their own. The ensuing backlash should have been the final nail in the coffin for FC, but as with many pseudosciences, it has simply refused to die. Howler himself, a former believer in FC, lamented that while the evidence is incontrovertible, it would take more to shift the convictions of communications. "We had overwhelming evidence for facilitator control," he said. "It began to dawn on us that the impact on facilitators was going to be traumatic. FC had become an essential part of their belief system, an essential part of their personality." Our ability to fool ourselves is unparalleled, and the idiomotor effect is just one persistent way of our own curious psychology that can push us towards erroneous conclusions. It serves as a reminder that no matter how compelling the anecdote, all claims must be scientifically evaluated to rule out our more innate capacity to delude even ourselves. In the words of Richard Feynman, the first principle is that you must not fool yourself and remember that you are the easiest person to fool. But, and you may study all the scientific textbooks, all of the research papers, and speak with as many world-leading scientists as you like, and you will get no more of an affirmative answer regarding the supernatural than you will affirmative. Because just as we cannot use known science and technique to prove the existence of supernatural forces currently, we also cannot use the same science and techniques to disprove them. Or so it is thought. There are experiments and investigations that provide outcome to disprove. They are the same that prove so inconclusive that it can't disprove any phenomena. Unless we forget, we all, even scientists, have our cognitive biases. Let's take the Skoll investigations of the 1990s. They were well known in the science world as being investigations into seances and other type of phenomena in the UK, Europe and the United States. In fact, professional scientists and other well-respected investigators at the time either took part in the series of investigations or observed in a professional capacity. And their conclusions? Well, the Skoll report was published in 1999, and within its pages it says this. In the course of over 20 sittings, the investigators were unable to detect any direct indication of fraud or deception, and encountered evidence favoring the hypothesis of intelligent forces, whether originating in the human psyche or from discarnate sources able to influence material objects and to convey associated, meaningful messages, both visual and oral. Whilst that's not entirely a smoking gun piece of evidence for the existence of your dead loved ones continuing to instigate communication after they've deceased, what it is fairly significant claim of is lack of dismissal of the phenomena on a large scale. You see, a number of skeptical and incredibly critical scientists attended the investigation and used numerous techniques in their arsenal to try and disprove supernatural phenomenon and the existence of psychical forces. And, simply put, they just couldn't. Or, if you'd prefer it in the simplest of terms, I have never seen or touched $1 million, but I have heard that it exists, as I know people who have seen and touched $1 million. Further, I am unable to disprove that $1 million exists, through scientific or other means. Now, just replace the words $1 million with any supernatural or paranormal phenomenon. Stuart Guthrie, Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at Fordham University, has studied paranormal phenomena at great depth, and perhaps surprisingly, is willing to state this. What is a ghost? A ghost is the dismembered spirit of a deceased person, he said. Why do we see them? We see them because the world is infinitely complex, and our means of understanding it are limited. It's a good bet to assume that there is something there, some sort of agent, when there is a thud in the darkest of the night. In the field of science, it takes a great visionary or a person really far out in left field to make bold statements, especially when they cannot prove them or unable to yet prove them. More often than not, their professional reputation and basis for funding might be at stake if they get something outrageously wrong. That's perhaps why many scientists like to take a back seat. They like to be the second or third to the table, so that it's someone else's neck on the line, but they are in there early enough to continue development of a proven hypothesis, thus furthering their career or reputation almost risk-free. Scientists willing to take that ultimate leap of faith are very rare, however, and perhaps one or two per generation only. They almost never come along. Q, world-renowned neuroscience researcher and professor of psychology at Canada's Laurentian University, Professor Dr. Michael Persinger. Slight geek moment here. When I studied psychology at university, Persinger was a bit of a hero of mine. Hugely respected in his field, he had a wealth of experience, knowledge, investigations, proven facts, and positive outcomes to a huge number of his experiments over the years. I read his published works in their entirety multiple times, and the man's hypothesis and theories sat perfectly right with me. He made sense, you know, and further, I could understand his viewpoint and second-guess the direction he would go with them. He was like a rock star to me, albeit a 70-year-old, well-spoken and well-dressed rock star. In 2012, I wrote a paper on the man, and in my confident, forthright attitude, called him on the telephone and was absolutely honored that he spared some 30 minutes of his time to speak with me about various subjects, but mainly about one subject in particular, which we'll come to shortly. You see, Dr. Persinger sadly died in 2018, and his research lives on, along with his good name. So, this episode is for you, Dr. P. Thank you for the science, and thanks for using part of your Sunday afternoon all those years ago to talk to a complete random stranger on the telephone from the other side of the pond. Now, Dr. Persinger was very unique. One thing that he said to me personally that has stuck with me for the last 9 years was, all conscious experience originates within the brain. You see, Persinger knew my stance on various paranormal phenomena through our conversation and my willingness to entertain an open mind in regards to various elements of what many would call fringe science. All conscious experience originates within the brain. What Dr. Persinger was saying was that he too shared the same willingness to allow his mind to be open in regards to things, shall we say, unproven. Ghosts, out-of-body experience, the afterlife, God, Satan, poltergeists, telepathy, psychokinesis, spirit mediums, he believed them all. And what's more, he could prove that they exist. You see, the human body is nigh on perfect. Millions of years of evolution has finely tuned our physical and mental being to allow us to conduct all that we do and all that we aspire to do. That's why, in the late 1980s, Dr. Persinger with his team at Laurentian University invented a neurotransmitting device that became known as the God Helmet. Persinger had discovered that when humans experience something that they could not explain, something supernatural, shall we say, that it triggered very unique readings in both the left and right temporal lobes of the brain. So unique was what he found that he had never come across the phenomenon before, and for all his research could not find any record of any other scientists discussing this or conducting any research into it either. So Dr. Persinger set about trying to recreate the brain readouts. And knowing that the brain essentially runs on electrical power, he undertook a series of lengthy experiments to see if he could force the brain to have the same reaction as it did when a human naturally experienced something fantastic. All experiences within the human psyche, such as love, hate, speech, reading, memories, etc., are all generated by brain activity. We know this. Science has proven this a million times over. So whilst we might not yet have the science or understanding to further examine the ghost phenomenon or what spiritualist mediums experience, we do know that it begins in the brain. Dr. Persinger went one step further and stated not only do these paranormal experiences start in the brain, their life cycle are in the left and right temporal lobes. Persinger was keen to identify what the parameters of the brain activity and structures were in the hope of being able to trigger it and recreate the experience as a direct lead to further investigating what each and every one of the aforementioned phenomena actually was. No one had ever thought this way before. No one had considered doing this. While many people the world over crawled through the dark with video cameras and atmosphere reading meters in the hope of catching a fleeting moment with a spook or spectre, no one had thought to really investigate this phenomenon, we need to capture the phenomenon or be able to recreate it in order to study it at length. Many called Persinger a crackpot, but the thing was, he was incredibly well respected and his work produced credible results. He was a leader in his field. So while people thought Persinger's latest scientific endeavor was crazy and like something out of a Hollywood movie, very few people were prepared to voice their opinions to the man publicly. This meant that the good doctor went relatively unchallenged and was afforded the luxury of being allowed to get on with his work. And get on with his work he did. Eventually, Persinger and his team, including the inventor Stanley Coren, constructed a helmet from an old snowmobile helmet. On each side sat two electromagnetic solenoids, which would pass a magnetic field directly into the temporal lobes at a strength of 1 microtesla. In order to reduce any electromagnetic interference or geomagnetism, the wearer of the helmet would be placed within an acoustic chamber, which also doubled as a Faraday cage. The helmet was connected to Persinger's control computer and operated manually at first before a program was created to run the experiment. Prior to anyone volunteering as a guinea pig for the God Helmet experiments, a suitability interview and questionnaire would be completed with each candidate so that Persinger could identify the likelihood of the experiments being a success. This is because Persinger, through previous experiments, had identified that only 80% of individuals could react to his lobe manipulation. Additionally, it was also important to Persinger that the individual being tested was of sound mind and in a good mental place, given the element of unknown outcomes associated with the experiment. Over a period of 20 years, Persinger conducted the experiment with his team and hundreds of willing test subjects with incredible outcomes. The experiments gave the test subjects interaction with ghosts, angels, the voice of God, as well as some darker forces. One test subject was so worried by their experience that they attempted to arrange for an exorcist to cleanse the doctor's laboratory. Although the experiences for everyone differed, almost all agreed that they had never experienced anything like it, and what the God Helmet did was quite literally out of this world. Persinger's experiments continued. He discovered the same type of brain stimulation can create mental states conducted to human telepathy. Persinger stated in 2014, "What we have found is that if you place two different people at a distance and put a circular magnetic field around both, and you make sure that they are connected to the same computer so that they can get the same stimulation in unison, then if you flash a light in one person's eye, the person in the other room receiving just the magnetic field will show changes in their brain as if they saw the flash of light themselves. We think that's a tremendous because it may be the first macro demonstration of a quantum connection or so-called quantum entanglement. There's another way of potential communication that may have physical applications, for example, in space travel." In 2008, the University of Southampton in the United Kingdom conducted the largest near-death experience investigation in history. Referred to as AWARE, or Awareness During Resuscitation, the study tested some 2,060 patients across 15 hospitals in the United Kingdom, United States, and Austria. The university published the findings of their study in 2014 in the science and medical journal called Resuscitation. Patients who had experienced cardiac arrest, whose lungs, heart, and brain had all ceased operational function, were resuscitated and asked to volunteer for inclusion into the study. Following the resuscitation and a period of convalescence, the patients were subjected to a series of structured interviews by medical professionals from within the study. The outcome of the study produced a number of really interesting findings, but most notably these. Firstly, it found 61 specific occurrences where the patient was clinically deceased, as in where the doctors present and medical monitoring equipment noted that heart, lungs and brain had no readable output and were then successfully resuscitated. Following this, they were able to clearly recall both visual observances and audible conversations from the room that they were in, and in some cases other rooms, in the time period when they were clinically dead. The second noteworthy point from this study is that a staggering 39% of patients who were resuscitated recalled dying and the moments after consciousness ended, and also being resuscitated and waking up. The 39% of patients, that's 803 people in total, also stated that they had a strong feeling that they perceived what happened after they had died, but that this memory had disappeared when they were resuscitated. So what's the relevance of all this science in terms of this episode? Well, I guess it's groundwork to explain what may seem pseudoscience is actually starting to gain some credible investigation. And indeed, where the time, energy and funding has been placed, real credible evidence and a foothold has been gained in answering some of the oldest questions that we have across many cultures. I won't burden you with too much more data and scientific jargon, with except the knowledge that in 2016, a team of six scientists from the Federal University of Mato Grosso do Sul in Brazil conducted research into the effects of the brain from a spiritualist medium while communicating, for lack of a better phrase, with the other side. The study included 10 females with a minimum of 5 years of spiritualist medium experience and 10 females who had no mediumship skills. This would be the control group to measure like for like. Each spiritualist medium was paired with a non-medium, and both would be hooked up to an electroencephalographic monitor, or EEG. Both would have their brainwaves monitored simultaneously in three stages, which were pre-reading, reading, and post-reading. The study found hyper-increased gamma band activity outside of the normal 30 to 200 Hz range in the spiritualist mediums when they were given their readings. This was consistent throughout and for all of the spiritualist mediums with experience. Gamma band activity in the human cerebral function is known at regular levels to control perception, attention, memory, consciousness, synaptic plasticity, and motor control. Take from this study what you will, but definitely bear in mind as we move on to tonight's focal subject. Now, regular listeners will know that this bonus episode is an offshoot or accompanying episode to the two previous episodes regarding our investigation into the ghost phenomenon. It's strongly urged that you listen to both of those episodes before continuing with this one, but don't worry, we will still be here when you come back. So in March 2020, my team and I conducted an investigation into the past haunting of one of our listeners, named Martin. We completed a thorough background investigation and dug deep into multiple family members. We conducted extensive interviews with Martin over a number of months and subjected him to polygraph testing and an investigation at his childhood home, which was now unoccupied. Martin accompanied us on this investigation, as did a paranormal investigation team from London that we had contacted to provide third-party expertise. The London team were acquainted with a spiritualist medium who had nearly 30 years of experience in her field, so we welcomed her along on the second night of the investigation too. We felt that the medium, whose name was Emma, could provide an alternative angle to our scientific approach into the investigation. I keep an open mind, shall we say, in regards to spiritualist mediums and phenomena of that ilk. Whilst I'm confident that I can spot cold reading, Barnum statements, and a multitude of common tricks used by many of the frauds out there, that doesn't necessarily mean that there could be individuals in existence that are able to do what they claim to. Open mind and a willingness to believe. Now, I mentioned about cold reading. Well, in the room during the seance ritual, although not directly taking part, was Mark from my team. Mark had specifically come as part of the investigation to monitor and shadow Emma, given his background and interest in mentalism, the 13 steps, magic, and the psychological sleight of hand techniques that are used so commonly by tricksters. The moral dark side of magic, as I like to call it, purely because the skills needed to perform some of this magic in the wrong hands could pose quite dangerous. Although it's nevertheless quite staggering when it's seen performed in front of your own eyes. One such example I can recall being in a record shop in my hometown. The person who I was with claimed, very confidently, that he would approach the person serving, purchase a badge for £1, and get her to willingly hand over £100 to him. Intrigued, I walked to the cash register with him, and he engaged in conversation with the store worker, asking how her day was going, if the store had been busy that morning, and if she liked the band that was named on the badge that he was purchasing. My friend handed the store worker a £5 note and said, "The badges are £1, is that right?" To which the store worker responded yes, took his £5 note, and then handed him £104 change. My friend looked over at me and grinned, before asking the store worker if she had given him the correct change. She even said, "Yes, that looks correct to me, £104 change." Eventually, my friend told her he only gave her a £5 note, and she apologised and corrected the mistake straight away, but my friend could easily have taken the money and left. Scary stuff. Although these days it's a dying art form, and the very old technique behind it has been out of print for literally decades, so trying to track down ways of learning the techniques is nigh on impossible currently. So Mark would be sat in the corner of the room observing what was being said and happening and recording the events. Directly involved in the seance ritual was myself. This wasn't my first seance rodeo, however. Grace from my team. It was her first seance. Martin, who was the subject of our investigation. And Emma, who would be conducting the ritual and would be the conduit to the spiritual world. Both my team and the London team agreed that as the London team had an existing relationship with Emma, that they would not take part in the ritual, but would monitor the events from the tech HQ in the garage. We chose the front room of the house for the ritual to take place. The only window in that room was boarded up as the house was currently unoccupied, so that was ideal given how the ritual needed to be performed in pitch black darkness, as Emma told us. We didn't need a table that is sometimes portrayed in film and television, which was ideal, Mark stated, as without a table it would be easier to identify any suspect occurrences in the seance. The room we were in was downstairs at the front of the house, and as the house was situated on a very small country road, there was no passing traffic or outside noise. Within the room, we placed four chairs facing each other closely in a circle. There were various camera and audio recorders in the room and a number of meters to measure any atmosphere changes. We expected temperature and humidity to increase with the addition of five people now in the room, but we didn't expect any changes to chemical composition of the air, radiation, electromagnetic readings, and so on. While setting up, Emma informed us that the link between our world and the spirit world is very weak, at the best of times, so it was necessary to maintain an ongoing connection of sound. She felt the best way to do this was to play orchestral music in the background at a low level. Whilst not ideal, due to the inclusion of the music meaning that it would be more difficult to differentiate any anomalous sounds upon playback of the audio, we agreed to the requirement. Once all who were meant to be in the room were present and the remaining persons had left, we tightly closed the door and sealed it all around and underneath with blackout tape. Additionally, we blacked out the keyhole in the door and hung a large thick blanket over the door and pinned it to the wall and floor. We hung a similar blanket over the window at the front of the room, and everyone left personal devices such as phones, electronic car keys, or pocket torches outside of the room. Emma took one of the seats, and myself and Grace used thick Velcro straps to firmly seal both of Emma's hands and feet to the arms and legs of the chair, allowing for no looseness of the straps for Emma to remove herself without alerting us to the sound of the tearing Velcro. Myself, Grace and Martin took our respective seats, and the four of us held hands with those either side of us. Mark firmly tied thick black cloth around our hands so that we couldn't uncouple without someone untying us first. Finally, Mark placed a thick black velvet hood over Emma's head, which covered her entire head down to her shoulders. The last action we took before we started was Mark reached up and removed the light bulb from the fitting in the ceiling, and he took his position silently in the corner. We were sat in the darkest of pitch black. Zero light entered the room, and it was too dark for our eyes to focus or adjust to. We were unable to see anything placed right in front of our eyes. The sound in the room was thick and static. All exterior sound was removed, and the atmosphere slowly became heavier. One thing Mark and I both agreed to watch out for when the ritual started was fishing. Emma, when she was relaying messages from the other side to us, we felt should not be guessing at names or information or trying to work out or ascertain facts. She could either hear and receive the messages, or she could not. Now, Emma knew nothing about any of us in that room other than our first names. We hadn't shared the history of the house or the area with her, and only gave her the address of where she was going later the night before. She also knew nothing about Martin's story, experiences, or family history. Then we began. Emma started us off. "Please bear in mind, everyone, that it takes a great deal of energy on the other side to come through, so those speaking may not be able to speak for long or have much to say. They also take away from your energy, so that you might find yourself tired and very emotional following this session, particularly the longer that it goes on." We all voiced our agreement. "Further," Emma said, "you must remember that the things I'm told or things that are said through me might be difficult to hear, might be rude, might be offensive. It's difficult to have a filter in this role. Please know that when you die, your life force or your energy leaves your physical body and goes to another place. But your energy never simply stops being you. It never stops loving and never lets go of everything that's important to you. I'm a physical medium, which is something that is very rare in this day and age. I know of only three others in this country besides my inner circle. Being a physical medium means that during my seances, individuals can manifest themselves in the room, can talk through me, and make physical contact with you. It might also mean ectoplasm. If that happens, I will secrete it, but please do not touch the ectoplasm until I say it's okay to do so, as the substance can be very dangerous." I could tell through the darkness that everyone was thinking the same thing about ectoplasm as I was. Gross. Emma continued, "Even though those who I contact can speak through me, I prefer to act as a traditional medium and have them speak to me, and I will communicate the message to you. I prefer this because it's possible that if you have an unfriendly force enter you or speak through you, it's not always easy to get them to leave. I work exclusively with what we mediums call a control. A control is a person on the other side who has lived previously, which acts as a spirit finder and communicator. My control is called Helena, and I've known her for almost 30 years, and I trust her explicitly. She communicates with me and passes messages through me to you, and vice versa. Is everyone comfortable and okay to begin?" Emma finished. We all confirmed that we were fine. I could feel Grace squeeze in my hand, and I knew that she was nervous. "Before we start, please clear your minds and think of nothing. Feel your body's energy and feel it flowing like a river through your body and down your arms. Let each other's energy engulf you and channel it to myself so that I may find the right vibrations. Dear spirit world, tonight I embrace you from the material world. Please grant us your audience and permit us to be connected with you. Through our heart, mind and soul, we embrace you. Please enlighten us with your knowledge and love, and use my energy to join with us, dear spirits. Amen." "Amen," we all followed. There was a long pause. I could hear Emma. Her breathing was getting heavier. "Good evening, dear friends. It's an honor and a privilege to be with you tonight." There was a noticeable drop in depth and tone to Emma's voice, which I was surprised by. I wanted to see clarification if it was still Emma, or if somebody was speaking through her. But I didn't want to break the rhythm, and I just kept in my head and remembered that Emma says that she liked other spirits to talk to her and not through her. Emma continued, "Martin, I know that we are here for you tonight, and there are several other people in this room with us at the moment who all know you. I'm going to talk about the presence who is with you first and who resides in this house. Do you understand what I mean?" "I think so, but not entirely," Martin responded. "When we walked into the room earlier, from the garage, a spirit attached itself to you right away and secured itself to your back. It's been with us all evening and is transfixed on you. It is with us now and says that its name is Stanley. Stanley has dwelled in this house for a long, long time and moved in when your family purchased this house. Stanley plays games and tricks. Stanley is mischievous. Martin, are you aware that your grandmother and grandfather were spiritualist mediums?" "I think I've come to realize that, yes," Martin replied. "Okay," Emma came back. "They were part of their own circle, a group of individuals who had all lost someone close to them that they were trying to contact. In trying to contact the spirits of loved ones so regularly, your grandparents opened a door that they didn't close, and that's how Stanley found you. As you were young, you had a tremendous life force, a life force energy that it could gain from, but it had to keep you close. It played with you and teased you and emulated a child to gain your trust. Do you understand this?" Martin responded with his voice shaking, "Yes. What is Stanley? Is he the spirit of a dead boy?" After a short pause from Emma, she gave Martin the answer I suspect he didn't want to hear, and an answer that sent a cold shiver down my back and arm. "No," Emma said, "he's not a young boy, but he wants you to think that he is." "So who or what is he?" Martin asked again. "I don't know, but he has never been alive in the physical world as we know it." Silence. "Is everyone okay to continue?" Emma asked. "Yes," we all said in nervous unison. As we said that, I picked up a faint smell of smoke, ever so subtle. "Can anyone else smell that?" Grace said. "A gentleman has joined us," Emma said. "I suspect Martin can tell us who it is from the smell of his pipe smoke." "It's my grandfather," Martin returned. "He has a message for you, Martin, and I'm going to voice his words, word for word. Do you understand that?" "Yes," said Martin. "He's saying that you have the answers that you've always wanted, so you should let go of the fear that you have within yourself and from your childhood. Let the fear go and let the house go. He says both him and your grandmother are incredibly proud of the man that you have become, and we are still with you every day, and we love you so, so much." Through the dark, I could hear the raw emotion coming from Martin. He asked Emma, "Emma, I asked my grandfather a question a few days ago. Can you ask him what the answer is?" "Of course," Emma replied. There was a short pause, and Emma said, "You asked your grandfather that if it's truly him that comes through at some point this weekend, to give you a code word that only you and your grandfather would know. He said the answer to that is Little Bear." Martin gasped and sobbed. "What is this, please?" Emma asked. "When I was a little kid," Martin said, "like 2 or 3, I used to have a teddy bear onesie. And ever since then, from that point, my granddad used to call me Little Bear as like a nickname." Martin asked if we could stop there, and Emma obliged. But before we did, Emma said she was keen to convince the two skeptics in the room, which obviously meant myself and Grace. Now, for the purposes of privacy, I won't say who she spoke to in the spirit world in relation to the message that I received. But, and please appreciate that I'm 100% deadly serious when I say this. Emma gave me a name outright, who was a deceased family member of mine, and told me what the relationship between them and myself was. She then told me something very personal that only me and that family member ever knew. Neither of us had spoken about it to anyone else. It was just something between the two of us. It was not written or logged down anywhere. It was just something personal, a conversation that happened between the two of us. There is no way she could have researched or found that information from anyone except me. And I have not spoken of it since I was around 10 years old with anyone. Emma had convinced me. No matter what you think or believe, what you have read and researched, or what your religion states is the truth, there are things out there that science cannot explain. At least not yet. But some things, all it takes to experience is a leap of faith. Thanks everyone, sleep tight. And remember, stand firm as you enter the darkest night.